This is The Guardian.
Hi everybody, Max here. Just to give you a heads up that today's pod is a little bit different. It's a conversation we had with John Barnes about his new book on racism. The book is far less about football than we imagined it would be, but that's fine. The boss says it's a tough listen. I'm not sure that's how we should sell it. You can decide, I guess. There's lots of disagreement right from the off. It's slightly more confrontational than I like life to be, but lots of differing ideas, some perhaps quite uncomfortable moments, but something we should all be continually thinking about, and I think it was definitely worth doing, and a subject we will obviously revisit. I hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Today, myself, Barry, Troy Townsend and John Barnes will discuss racism in football and society. John's written a book, The Uncomfortable Truth About Racism. We've all read it and we'll use it to try and ask some difficult questions and, if possible, come up with some solutions about racism in the game. Right now, footballing authorities are struggling to deal with what's in front of them. Players racially abusing each other, fans racially abusing players in the stadium, anonymous online racial abuse, a woeful lack of representation in the dugout and in the boardroom. There's a lot to discuss, so let's get on with it. This is The Guardian Football Weekly. I would say that we have the finest minds to solve something that hasn't been solved in 1,000 years of civilization, but since me and Barry make up half the panel, there's a lot of heavy lifting for Troy and John. Barry, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Max.
Troy Townsend, hello.
Hello. All well, thank you.
And John Barnes. John Barnes, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you.
We've had a few questions in, mostly, can you still do the rap from World in Motion? we may get to it late. You'll never get away from that, I imagine. But look, you've written a book, The Uncomfortable Truth About Racism. What motivated you to write it?
What motivated me to write it is when we came onto this show, we are here to discuss the solution to getting rid of racism in football and society, as you say. And we've been saying that for years. Let's do it the other way around. Let's get rid of racism in society and football, because all we're doing is focusing so heavily on football that we're neglecting society. And that is the big problem. We're looking to make it better for an elite group of people. And I look at it from an intersectionality point of view with women and gay people as well. And we're looking to elevate the elites into these positions whereby we give the illusion that we're trying to be inclusive, where nothing changes for the people in the inner cities, because no one is talking about them. We're talking about racist Hungarian fans. I understand that footballers go through a hard time. I do understand that. But the black community go through a much harder time, an infinitely harder time, and we seem to be neglecting them. So that is what this book is about. It's not about my experiences or Obama's or other elite black people. It's the black people who I feel are being neglected by allowing us just to focus. The system allows us just to focus on a particular group of elite people. And we believe if we get them more representation and more power, it'll filter down to the masses. And as you said, in 1,000 years, that's not happened for white working class people, for white working class women. So what I'm doing, and everybody has to do it their own way, and we have to do both, but I feel that the neglected, underprivileged black people who aren't elite are being let down.
So I guess the question is, can you in any way talk about any problems within football and racism? Like is that a legitimate area for conversation?
Absolutely. It's a microcosm of society. But until we get rid of it in society, it will exist in all walks of society, of which football is one. Now, what would happen is if you're a great footballer and you don't miss penalties in the Euros, then you won't get racist abuse on Twitter. But if you're a bad black footballer, you're going to get racist abuse. So, and if that's what we think the solution is to getting rid of racism, to have black footballers who only play well, black singers who are only good, black actors who are only good, and we're going to get praise and support and acceptance, and that's how we evaluate equality because there's no more racism towards them, then we're sadly mistaken.
I think it's interesting in the book that you do talk about your football experiences. You don't spend a lot of time talking about them. You give the impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the racist abuse that you received, and you received a lot of it, never really bothered you.
Didn't bother me at all. Because you also have to look at it from a class, race, experiences, individual experiences point of view. And as a light-skinned Jamaican young man who came to England at 13 was brought up with a politically and socially elite family in Jamaica who would have experienced, I never experienced any feeling of inferiority. And in fact, as a middle-class light-skinned Jamaican, there are times when I would have been discriminating against black working-class Jamaicans, not because they're black, but because of that class. So when I actually came to England fully empowered and white people wanted to make me feel inferior by throwing bananas at me. That couldn't, because that couldn't affect me. And I'm not belittling anybody else's experience in terms of if they felt heavily insulted and they needed to fight and needed to walk off the field. And that's why I have empathy with everybody, what they're doing now, if they feel that's what they need to do. But we have to stop saying all Black people are the same, and we have to react the same, we have to feel the same. And if you don't feel the same as a Black person who wants to walk off the football field, then therefore you're a racist apologist or you're a traitor. We have to stop doing that. We're not all the same.
John, you say in the book that you don't think footballers should walk off the pitch if they're being racially abused, because if a Black bus driver or a Black postman or a Black traffic warden walked away from their workplace, it wouldn't end well for them. But surely if someone like a footballer or a musician walks off the pitch or the stage, if there's a subject of racial abuse, that sort of sends out a message to the person abusing them that it's not okay. And it's not okay to abuse me or the bus driver or the postman or the traffic warden. It'll give them food for thought.
That's not the message. The message is not okay to abuse me. You think they're not going to abuse the postman or the person who works at McDonald's because they can't abuse me? You may not be able to abuse Alan Sugar, but can you abuse a white working class person? That doesn't make people look at the average man in Brixton and say, oh, because I love Raheem Sterling and I'm not going to abuse him, that I see him as equal. That is why we have to do it from the bottom up. We have to get the respect for the people at the bottom rather than doing it from the top down. And we've been doing it top down for hundreds of years and it hasn't worked.
John, do you mind if I take you back to your early experiences, particularly playing? You talk about, you know, being shocked at hearing, you know, white teammates almost banter as such, but banter towards the Black players. I know you said that you've not been affected by it all, but you use the term shocked, which must mean that you were affected originally as you kind of, you know, were coming into this fear and understanding that the landscape of football for a young Black person.
Yes. When I say shocked, I was shocked at the response of, God, don't forget, I'm a young 17-year-old boy playing. And when that happens, that is an overt act of racism, which I think is an attack on me. But then I was shocked, first of all, to hear it, but then to see that the way Luther and other players respond to it, that they were their friends and they were talking to them and they're all hugging and having a laugh and having a joke. And then I realized after a while that, hang on a second, that insult that I've actually given you, taken out of context in the street, is when you're going to start to fight. But this is on the pitch with your friends. And I was shocked by the acceptance that this is the way it actually is. When I say shocked, I don't mean shocked in terms of it affecting me negatively. I was shocked at the dynamic itself, because having not been brought up in England and in that environment, where I suppose it had been going on for a long period of time for people who were brought up in England to actually see that, if that was to happen where I was brought up, that is really fighting talk, if you know what I mean. But it wasn't in football. It was what was considered to be banter.
So was it culture then that kind of existed throughout your career, or did it kind of, because of that acceptance then as the player, did it kind of eventually die away?
No, what I then separated it from, and to give you an example, as much as I say it didn't affect me and I was shocked, but from a footballing perspective, even as a young 18, 19-year-old footballer, while I say in football, when I recognise the fact that if that banter went on, that I was only a laugh and it was only a joke, I would not have accepted that banter out of football. So therefore, if I'm walking down the street and that happened, that would have been much more impactful on me if I'm walking down the street and people I don't know come up, and because that's when it's real. Mm-hmm. That's what I, you know, and people say, you're saying, oh, it's not real. It is real, because from a footballing perspective, with your teammates and the banter within your teammates, it is their unconscious bias that they don't even understand why they're actually doing it, because I'm only having a joke, I'm having a laugh, you're my best mate. And this is how we speak, because they don't understand unconsciously, subliminally, they have been conditioned to think in terms of racial hierarchy and superiority. So even if in a jokey way, that's what they do. Whereas in the street, when it actually happens, it's serious. Because it's not my friend coming up to me to call me a Black so-and-so or abusing me. It's not my mate, and we're not having banter. And that is why I always differentiated it between what goes on the street and what goes on in football.
At what point does it become unacceptable in football? At what point do we say, you know, yes, you're a teammate or a colleague or whatever that may be, but what you have said or the banter that you are displaying is unacceptable?
It's always unacceptable. It's always unacceptable. However, if we want to get rid of it, we have to get rid of it in society before we get rid of it in football. I've never said it's acceptable in football. It is absolutely unacceptable. But we cannot solve the problem in football until we solve it in society.
But don't you think that we have to make little changes in every
sphere of life for it to change in society. Because if we just say we have to change it in society, well, that's how do we do that if we're not changing it in football, in music, in every part of culture, on the street, everywhere?
Systemic racism affects us all, and systemic racism comes from the top. So I'm not talking about changing it from the top, but I'm talking about looking at it from a holistic point of view. So if we change it in football, how's that going to affect travelers? How's that going to affect women? How's it going to affect discrimination? Comes from the perception of superiority and inferiority over a certain group of people based on what we have historically told about them. So therefore, if we deconstruct and dismantle the idea of racial superiority, gender superiority, generally speaking, it will then filter down into all walks of society. It won't. Changing it in football isn't going to dissipate into society. It'll just change it in football. So therefore, if you're just looking at your own little compartment, what could happen possibly is you could change it in your own department. And you can't change it in your own department by doing what we're doing, because what we're doing is trying to pass laws. And pass laws doesn't change perceptions. So what would happen is that it is now illegal at a football match to throw bananas. There are no more bananas coming on the field, is there? Have we solved the problem? No. You're not allowed to go, ooh, ooh, ooh. They're not doing that anymore, are they? But has it solved the problem? No. So we're going to ban them booing. So they'll do something else. If you're looking to pass laws to change anything, it will not work. It's been illegal to rape and steal and kill for 1,000 years, but they're still doing it. They're still doing it. So laws can't change anything. What you have to do is change people's perceptions. And once you change people's perceptions of Black people, of women, be it in football, be it in any little industry, in your own thing, then it'll change for everybody.
John, at various points during the book, you say that the Rooney rule is a waste of time. Black players taking a knee is a waste of time.
No, I didn't say black players taking a knee is a waste of time. Well, I said I don't care whether they take the knee or not.
Okay, so you said it was futile.
What it does, it highlights the issue. It doesn't solve the issue. And that's what we think. Keep taking a knee is going to solve the issue. It's not. It's highlighting the issue. Let's do something else. And the more we just talk about whether we should still be taking the knee or not, the more we're doing nothing else about why we're taking the knee. And you think if we take the knee for the next 25 years, the same problems would be solved just by taking the knee. So it's a good start to highlight it, but now it's been doing it for over a year. We've not got any further.
You highlight as well the futility of players walking off the pitch, players wearing a kick it out t-shirt.
No, I never said that.
I'm pretty sure you did. To wear the t-shirt. I think you did.
It's about highlighting the problem. It's about highlighting the problem. What happens is when things are taken out of context by a group of people to divide rather than coming together, and all these pretend allies, I'm not going to point any fingers, who say, I'm on your side, but this is happening, it goes on now. This is the problem. This is the problem where people who pretend to be on our side, I'm not naming names, who then want to then take things out of context to refute what we're trying to do, that is also a problem.
Okay, well, I suppose that point I'm trying meandering towards is that you highlight a lot of problems in your book, but you do not offer a single solution.
I don't offer a single solution.
No.
Changing the perception and understanding why you are racially biased, you, me, we all are, and looking at ourselves rather than pointing the finger at the ones who get caught, that's the start to the solution. Rather than pointing the finger, Barry, are you racially biased in any way?
Yes.
You are. So you're the problem. You are the problem.
Yeah, I know I'm the problem.
What are you doing to change?
But you don't... You've written a book that's 300 pages long, but you don't... I've read every page of it, and I put it down. You didn't give me any advice on what I should do to be less racially biased.
What the advice you should do is stop pointing the finger at Hungarian racist fans and look at your own system that you're working with, the company you work with. The Guardian newspaper are part of the system. We're all part of the system, and we have to understand that. But because we benefit from the system, we ignore that and point the finger at Bulgarians and Hungarians without looking at our own system that we're involved in, which is about nuance, which is about discriminate against the masses. And as an Irishman, you will know about discrimination. I think you're Irish. You would know about what the Irish did and the perception that the people had of the Irish based on the lies that they were told about them. And the lies that were told about Black people for hundreds of years about their moral and intellectual inferiority still unconsciously affects us all. Now, if we look at that and we say we have to stop thinking in terms of hierarchy, why do we think in terms of hierarchy? Because of what the lies we have been told, and we deconstruct it within ourselves. So do you agree that you are part of the problem, Barry, or not? Or is it just Peter Beardsley and the racist football fans?
No, I am part of the problem. But
and what are you doing to change?
Well, I'll tell you, I have very little control over much that goes on in The Guardian, but one bit I do have a bit of control over is this podcast. And a few years ago, it was drawn to our attention that it was comprised almost entirely of middle-aged white men. So we did something to change that. We made the panels more diverse. We brought in women. We brought in black voices. We continue to do that. You, in the book, suggest that is a waste of time.
It is a waste of time because what you're doing is you're putting more elite black people into positions. And the problem with racism doesn't affect the elite black people. It affects the black people down below and the women down below and the gay people down below. And until we change our perception of them, nothing will change. And what will happen is when we get rid of racial discrimination, gender discrimination, homophobic discrimination, the majority of black people, women and gay people will still be exploited and discriminated against because that is the way we live in this capitalist world. However, they won't be discriminated against or exploited because they're black or because they're female or because they're gay.
Should we be doing anything about racism in the stands or a player racially abusing another player or online abuse, racist abuse to footballers?
You can do very little, as you found out in UEFA, because how do you prove it? We live by the rule of law. We live by the rule of law. And you can see, and Troy will understand this, in terms of what FIFA and UEFA have done, they can do very little. Because what is racist abuse? You are allowed to boo a black player every time he gets the ball because booing is not against the law. And we know what they're doing. We know what they're doing. They're racially abusing them, but you are allowed to boo. And as much as you go, oh, that's racism, ban them. No, we can't. All of the fines or anything that UEFA or FIFA do to the football clubs is really because of violence. Now, we know there's racism involved because you can actually prove violence. So all of the flare throwing and all of the aggression towards the stewards, FIFA will say, we're going to fine you for the violence. And we go, what about the racism? And they go, what racism? What racism? Because unless you are actually going to throw a banana on the field, which they don't anymore, unless you're going to go, ooh, 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 very little can be done in football about that because we are governed by the rule of law.
Troy, keep that thought. We'll do it at the start of part two. You're listening to The Guardian Football Weekly. Welcome back to The Guardian Football Weekly. Troy, you had a question.
I did. John, I want to take you back to something that you said just a little bit earlier in part one about the banana and about the monkey chanting. 1988. What was that experience like? Because I want to compare it to 2018 when a banana did land on a football pitch again, back in the Premier League, and very little was said about what the significance of that banana, particularly thrown at a black player. But first of all, what was that experience like for you? And did it impact you in any way at all as a black player on the field of play?
Well, first of all, that iconic picture of me back in the banana, it looks very poignant and iconic. And if you ask me, I do not remember doing that at all. Don't forget, this was Liverpool versus Everton, a high-profile match, two of the best teams in the country, because Everton were, and Liverpool throughout the 80s were the two best teams. Everybody's watching. A big deal was made of it. I've been playing football since 1980, 81. Bananas were coming on the field when I played for Watford for 6 years. You speak to black players and they were on the field. So this wasn't a new thing for me. So, you know, it's not as if this is the first time it happened, so I'm kicking it off because I'm disgusted. This happened all the time. The photographer captured a great moment. But in terms of it resonating with me at the time, thinking, I'm back eating a banana off, this is going to be special, I don't even remember doing it because you have to remember this was a regular occurrence every time we played. So it's easier to look back in retrospect. It's like looking back in slavery and saying, oh, how terrible that must that have been. We can't really feel it. So looking back and judging it by today's standards, even remembering by today's standards, it meant nothing because when you become desensitized, and I wasn't desensitized to it because it never affected me, and I really do mean that. But when even black players who were affected back in the 80s become so desensitized to it, and you're looking back and you're going, it must have been horrible. After a while, it doesn't become horrible because it becomes normal. So it was just a normal, everyday thing, which people today probably can't understand because it is a horrific scene looking back. But at that particular time, it meant nothing. It meant nothing.
John, I use it all the time. I used it in front of 90 young people yesterday in a school in Brixton. And I understand what you're saying. I always see the power of it and the power of how it can influence those young people as well to take them back into that period of time. But then 2018... the banana thrown at Aubameyang has no connotations around racism. I mean, I couldn't understand the situation. I still don't understand the situation. The reports were all about a missile being thrown on the football field and, you know, how football doesn't have a racism problem. It has a missile problem, kind of in line with what you were saying earlier. it seems like the banana on your football field, although I appreciate what you've said there, you know, was more of a story in regards to racism than the 2018 incident, when we're supposed to have better educational systems and better understanding and people showing more appreciation. Why do you think that is? What are we not doing right at that period of time that we can't call it for what it is?
We're not educating people out of the football arena. In fact, I think that the rest of society is leaving it to football to solve the problem. And football can only solve its own problems, as you say, in the football stadium, in and around the stadium on a match day. That's what we can do. People are conditioned and they're influenced outside of the football arena, outside of the sphere of football, every single day until for 90 minutes on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night when they come in. So if we don't tackle it outside of football and people still have these misconceptions outside of football, when all of a sudden they come into a football match once a week and they have these ideas about racial hierarchy or gender hierarchy instilled in them, and when they can remember to bite their tongue and not to throw a banana on the field because they know they're going to get in trouble, they don't do it. However, you will know what football is like. Football is an emotive game where people get het up, they get angry, and some people then let it out in the way they have been conditioned to think to their detriment. And what happens is people who think the exact same way, who can control themselves, don't shout out. They don't throw a banana on the field. And the one who does, we say, that is unusual and that is unique. When you have fans racially abusing a player, and if it's 20 fans, how many fans in that stadium do you believe, if they were allowed to by law, to racially abuse a player would? If they were allowed to. Because of the way they've been conditioned and the way that they actually feel. And in a football environment whereby you are the enemy. And how can I let you know you're the enemy? How I've been told I'm superior to you? So most of them keep their mouths shut.
I get the impression from the book that you think more people should say kind of what their biases are, like be much more open, but people you suggest are scared to say anything because they want to say the right things.
South Africa, Rwanda, they had a truth and reconciliation in apartheid. Mm-hmm. Don't come forward and say you didn't do anything. Don't come forward and say you don't do anything, but you knew you did something. We know you did something, but we can't prove it. But if you want to move forward, you have to be honest. You have to be honest. So, of course, white people don't come forward and say anything, because if they come forward and say anything, what's going to happen to them? They're going to be sacked. They're going to be canceled. They're going to be called racist. Now, it's obvious if someone's going to throw a banana on the field or racially abuse somebody, that's racism. And if I don't do that, I am not racist. But if I'm walking down the road as a woman and a group of black youths come towards me, I'm going to be a bit scared, hold my handbag and cross the road. Am I racist? Yes. But you can't prove it because I'm just crossing the road. Now, why does she think that way? Because what life has wrongly told her about groups of black youths. So don't blame the people who think that way. Challenge the institutions and the environment that makes us think that way. And stop making scapegoats and coming down hard on people when, obviously, yes, you're going to throw a banana on the field, you're going to kill a black man, you go to prison. But the majority of people don't do that, but they still feel racially superior or from a gender point of view or homophobic point of view. But because we're so quick to just cancel everybody and sack everybody if they do it, everybody then goes, I don't do it. I don't think it.
Working in the game and being close to it, the language that is used within our sphere. And I want to ask you a question about elite black people as well, who are classed as elite black people. Because, you know, I have this now through the lower league. We don't talk about the lower leagues. We don't talk about non-league as far as people are concerned in the industry, by the way. Racism and discrimination doesn't happen through those circles. And that's what worries me, because on a daily basis, I have, you know, black players, brown players, players from other backgrounds talking to me all the time about the discrimination they receive. So when you talk about elite black players or elite people, black people, sorry, who are we talking about here?
Well, the non-elite are the ones who you just mentioned.
Right.
The ones, they're professional footballers. They could even be in League One. They could even be in the Premiership. The ones who are talked about are the elite ones. Now, you look at football and look at the microcosm of life. Then you come out of football and you go down into the lower echelons. And I hate saying that, but it's a fact of black society where you've got young black kids in London and all over the country. They are also non-elite. So the elite ones are us, because here we are. Here we are, because we are doing things like this. We're doing things like this. And what are we talking about? What are we talking about? We need more people like us, and how terrible it is for us, and how terrible it is for Raheem Sterling, and how terrible it is. Who is talking, as you said, Troy, for those boys in the non-league? I haven't seen in the paper anything about any one of them. And more incidents happen to them than happens in the top. Now, go further down and say you're not even playing football. You're just a bus driver, or you're just whatever. Who talks for them? And that's my whole point, and that's the essence of the book. We have to start looking at it from the bottom up. We're 3% black people in the country. What is the percentage of black people now on television? And we look at that as a representation of us being fair and being more inclusive because we've got more black people on television. When nothing changes for the vast majority of people down below, and we convinced ourselves that things are getting better because we've got more black elite. And I use us to say, let's look at history and say for the white working class and non-elite people, nothing has changed. And who's talking about football fans? The black football fans who get abused every single day when they go to stadiums, when they come out of the stadiums, when they're in the stadiums. But that's not mentioned until a black superstar player on the pitch gets abused. And it's still not mentioned about them.
That'll do for part two. Back in a minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. John, it's practically difficult to change what the establishment are doing. Sort of whoever, I mean, I guess, am I in the establishment? I probably am. But it's difficult for, you know, Brian, the football fan who wants to be an anti-racist and wants to be an ally, who's walking down the street listening to this pod or in the gym, to think, what can I practically do? What can I actually do to be the best anti-racist, the best ally I can do? I can't really change society from the bottom up because I've got to go home and cook dinner, you know?
What we can do is, if we want allies, yeah, we have to stop making people feel guilty. Yeah? So, white privilege. White privilege is a thing, 100%. This is how we should explain white privilege to our white working class people, because they're the people we're blaming for being racist anyway. We're blaming them. We're not blaming the establishment. We're blaming them or Hungarian fans. We should say to them, you know, you can't get a house, you can't get a job, you can't get a car, you can't pay your bills, but you've got white privilege. Explain to me, I don't have white privilege. You know, the black man who is in the inner city, who is just like you, he goes through everything you go through. He can't get a job, he can't get a house, he's starving, he can't pay his kids, just like you, as well as the added burden of being black, whereby the perception we have generally of black people is that they're inferior. And if he then empathizes with, well, if he's just like me, and he's even worse because we think of him in a negative way, maybe I can become an ally. How can I become an ally when you're showing me people who I wish I had what they had, and the fact that a banana comes on the field, because they don't understand that anyway. So you can never explain to a white person what it's like to be racially abused. So you can't say to him, imagine if you were racially abused. He would say, so what? Someone call me a white, whatever. And he doesn't feel it. Now, the most interesting thing is if you say to a white working class person, haven't got a job, hasn't got a car, can't pay my bills, can't do anything, yeah? They say, you know what? You can have £250,000, £100,000 a week. You could have a big house, big car, live in hell, live in a mansion, but you have to be black. Very few people will take that chance. And how irrational is that? Because we judge the success on where we live in terms of the Western environment we live in, money, housing, acceptability. We can go to restaurants, we can go to the front of the queue as success, markers of success. So if they're the markers of success and I can have all of that and all I'd have to do is to be black, please, I'll have that any day of the week. But we have been conditioned so many years to think in terms of white superiority that his whiteness supersedes the fact that he could have all of that, but he would have to be black. Why? That's how irrational it is. And this is how we've been conditioned, and he wouldn't even know why. He wouldn't even know why. Because if you said to him, you could have all of that, but you'd have to be American, white American, he would take it, wouldn't he? Because at least he's still white.
John, I struggle a little bit because the one thing is, you know, and I understand where you're coming from, but then I also struggle a little bit as well, because football seems to be able to, or many people talk about how football can influence society in many, many different ways. And, you know, how players have their own foundations and projects that help, you know, their communities, etc. I'm still struggling to understand why football, in a broader sense, cannot influence on racism if football does things properly in its own environment. Because the people that come into the environment are from society. You will have experienced this as well as me. The many people that come up to you and say, thank you for speaking out, thank you for talking on our behalf because we have no voice. Why is it then that football cannot go and... If football did things properly, and it's a long way from doing it, by the way, and I'm for one going to sit here and say that, why can it not influence on a mass scale in society?
What football can do, football can provide opportunities either educationally, vocationally, from a financial point of view, because they have lots of money in terms of what you're talking about, foundations. It can do that. It can't change people's perceptions on the negativity surrounding the inferiority of black people or women. because that is to change people's perceptions. And these perceptions are ingrained in us for hundreds of years and continue to be ingrained in us by the media talking about people's inferiority. And I just mentioned some things there about, you know, Yadi gangs. And so therefore, in society, we're continuing this hierarchy of certain groups of people. And football now is saying, yes, we're putting in place structures to help. If you're involved in the football industry, yes, we can help you. Or even if you're underprivileged, we can actually, because we have money, we can set up schools, we can set up, but that's not going to change people's perceptions and the majority of people's perception. The majority of people aren't football fans. So when you talk about role models and you talk about the influence football has, we talk about Raheem Sterling, we talk about, you know, whatever role models you want to talk about and who they affect. In the corridors of power and the future leaders of Britain and even of the world, when you talk about people go to Yale, Harvard, Eton, Harrow, these are the future leaders of the world. I don't think that Harry Kane and Paul Gascoigne are their role models. And they're the ones making the decision. So they don't care what footballers think. They're part of the system, which is going to discriminate against the majority of people from a class and elite point of view. They don't care what's going on down below. So we can do what we can do down below in terms of helping each other. But that's not going to change the system, which has to discriminate against people. So I applaud football in terms of what it actually does. And Marcus Rashford did a fantastic thing in terms of using his... Marcus Rashford could have given £250,000 of his own money to some kids to eat their dinner. Or he could have said whatever he said. But he used his platform to change government policy to so many underprivileged kids. And while that's not a race issue, it's an underprivileged issue. Mm. And where lots of black people find themselves. So if footballers were to use their platform for that more than complaining about a Hungarian fan, I'm saying, yes, we have to do that. And we're doing lots of that. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying either or. But if they're to use their platform to do more of that, imagine what could be achieved.
I think they do, John. I think they do. You know, I'm the one that moans about Bulgaria or naming clubs in this country. And I don't think I'm elite, by the way. But I think there's this perception that footballers still don't do enough to help broader society. And I think it's wrong. And I think it's quite damaging as well because of how much time. And maybe it doesn't even get, obviously, the exposure that it should do. But do you think that Marcus Rashford could have challenged the government if he wasn't playing for Manchester United?
He couldn't. And that's what I'm saying. Use that platform to challenge the government, not to do something for what's going on here in the inner cities, not to challenge the government to ban a Hungarian fan. Well, that's not going to change anything in this country. These footballers are taking the knee and they're fighting for... How many black managers are there, Troy?
Five, I think, yeah.
Very few. How many footballers are coming out and asking, where are the black managers?
Yeah, closer to the end of their careers, more important. But yeah, probably, rather than during the time.
Because they want to be managers, yeah? Okay. Mm. Okay. So when it affects them, they complain and they talk about things when it affects them. But when it doesn't...
This is the thing, though. I mean, when Danny Rose came out and said it, he was ostracised. You know, he said he wouldn't go into the managerial system because of the way that it had treated black managers. But then all of a sudden, Danny Rose is the problem. We've got to also identify, John, that when black players speak up, they deem to be part of the problem rather than trying to get to the part where the solutions are created, like Barry mentioned earlier.
Right. So they have to be careful about what they speak up against.
Yeah.
Or else they're going to get ostracized.
Yeah.
So what do? They speak out against people who really are inconsequential to the system discriminated against black people. Eastern European Hungarians, Peter Bears. These people aren't the reason why. So if we are then saying the powerful black player, we're going to stand up. Yes, you stand up and talk and say what's right. Black managers. Oh, no, we're not going to talk about that. Because we're going to have to point the finger at people who actually are part of the system, who we depend on, and who could ostracize us if we do.
Yeah, but I think the right people do talk in that space. John, you mentioned Peter Bearsley twice, John.
Yeah.
Is there a specific reason for that?
Yes. Because Peter Bearsley is no different than anybody else you see on Sky television and everybody else at that particular age who didn't get caught and who are pointing the finger at Peter Bearsley and saying that is unacceptable and that is a problem. Martin Luther King, 1963, such a long time ago, such a wise man, said, the shallow understanding by good people about bias, racial bias, is more detrimental and a bigger obstacle than the total misunderstanding of bad people. What he means by that is that we look at the total misunderstanding of bad people and say they're the problem. The shallow understanding of racial bias means that people who say, I would never call anybody black so-and-so, I would never rape a woman, so therefore I don't discriminate. They are the obstacles and they are the problems to progress. And Peter Bearsley is one who may have had an absolute misunderstanding, but most people are with a shallow understanding of believing that because I wouldn't do that. And many others.
Okay, let's be clear. I've got it here. 2019, Peter Beardsley was banned from football for 32 weeks after being found guilty of three charges of racially abusing black players while coach of the Newcastle under-23s. An FA independent panel found that Beardsley had called a player of black African origin a monkey and had told black players on a trip to Go Ape that, quote, you should be used to that. The panel said it did not believe that Beardsley, who denied all the allegations, was racist, but it did conclude he had committed acts of racial discrimination, saying, quote, it's also relevant that he has not had the benefit of training and education about offensive racist remarks and the importance of not making them. Now, most people wouldn't say something like he did, which is why he got banned, because what he said was completely unacceptable.
Well, shall I tell you who called me a monkey?
Okay.
I won't. You know why? Because he'd get sacked. And shall I tell you who called people black bastards?
But John, does that make it acceptable? Does that make it acceptable?
No, it's not acceptable. But we should stop pointing the finger at scapegoats and think that they are unique. Because there are people still in the industry who are exactly like that, but who haven't been caught. Peter Beardsley is like everybody else. End of story.
But he's not like me or Barry, because we wouldn't call a black person a monkey.
So, do you feel comfortable if you're in an all-white club or an all-black club? Where would you feel more comfortable, Max?
I mean, a club is not, if you listen to this podcast, you know, neither. But okay.
Where would you feel more comfortable?
I'm in a nightclub. I honestly don't think I'd be, you don't believe me, but I just don't think I'd give a shit. I just don't think I would. I mean, I'd just be thinking it's really noisy.
Okay, you wouldn't give a shit. You wouldn't give a shit. But there's a door and you can see through the window, all white people, all black people. You've got to go into one. Which one are you going into?
Well, it depends who's invited me to the place, doesn't it? I mean, it's a really hypothetical situation.
And here's the problem, because people don't like these uncomfortable questions and they go, no, it doesn't matter to me. I don't see colour. I don't see race. It doesn't matter.
But I'm sure I have biases, right? But I'm constantly trying to be as good a person as I can be regarding race, gender, sexuality, or just be a nice person, right? That's what I'm constantly trying to do. And I think most people are trying to do that.
We are. But what we have to do is have a conversation whereby we can show our biases by saying together as people, you know, I did feel uncomfortable because I was in that place and there's a black guy coming there. But if you say that, you're going to get cancelled. You're going to get sacked. So the best thing to do is keep your mouth shut, wait for someone to get caught, and then say, we're solving the problem because we're banning Hungarians. And so therefore, everything is okay. And that is a bigger problem because we will then believe and create this illusion that it doesn't exist because we've got rid of the racist and nothing will change.
Do we think, I mean, I think the good thing is you haven't walked off, John. So hopefully our questions were sensible enough. Do you think we've solved anything in this hour?
No, we've opened a topic for conversation, which I would like people to have honest conversations rather than politically correct conversations about what we have to do, language I have to use, I'll never do this, I'll never say that. We have to be open and have, as they did in Rwanda, South Africa, a truth and reconciliation about the way we feel. And then we can come together to start. If we're just going to make scapegoats and point the fingers at the ones who get caught, and as Martin Luther King said, the majority of people won't get caught, and they're the ones who are still within the system, and they are the ones who are framing the system, nothing will change.
I've enjoyed this. It's been more confrontational than I'm used to. I don't really like confrontation, Barry, as you know. And I've been invited to a nightclub, which I certainly don't want to go to. Thanks so much, John. Good luck with the book. We appreciate your time.
All the best, lads.
Troy, it's a nice pleasure. To see
you. All the best.
Thanks, John.
Cheers, Barry.
Cheers.
This is The Guardian.